welcome to the Raising Kaelin podcast. My name is Mar Schneider and I blog at raisingkaelin.org, where we curate resources for parents raising children with disabilities. In today's episode 115, we chat with Martha Sumer Chadwick, who is a music educator as well as musician. And our talk is centered on music science or music therapy. This episode is dedicated to the memory of Stephen Harrell. As always, the content provided on this podcast is for your information only, and if you seek advice for your specific situation, to always contact a trained professional. So grab that cup of coffee, put your feet up, and get ready for some awesome conversation. I am totally excited to be talking to Martha Sumer Chadwick today. Martha is an illustrious pianist. She is a musician, an educator, as well as an advocate for the use of music therapy. Martha, welcome to the Raising Kaelin podcast.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Martha, I first listened to you last year at the Tennessee Mega Disability Conference. And I must say, your talk on the neural tangle just really fascinated me when you spoke about the power of music therapy. And I'm so glad that you are now able to join us today to tell the listeners about some of those benefits of music therapy. Before we get started, though, just so that we can kind of have some background information about you, would you kindly give us your backstory?
Sure. And I'll start off by saying that I am not a certified music therapist. So make that little disclaimer up front. But I got really, really fascinated with music therapy. It had to be, I'm dating myself, 30 years ago when I was teaching in a studio at the Chautauqua Conservatory in Chattanooga. And I had a brilliant student who had an autistic sibling. And this little girl at that point was 4 years old, and she had all of the typical traits of autism. She'd kind of spin in circles and run around. And she was not verbal, but she was echolalic. So she would kind of, every once in a while, something would pop out, but she would not initiate speech. And her mother asked me if, you know, I could teach her to play the piano. And I knew what I knew as a standard piano pedagogue at that point. And I said, well, okay, sure, I'll give it a try. Well, I'll tell you, between you and me, it was not good. And I was 6 months later kind of saying, okay, what am I going to do here? And then her mother found out that this little girl was a whiz with computers. Mm-hmm. And I had a notational software called Finale loaded on my computer at home. And so we took her to my home for her lessons. And over the course of 3 years, she learned to read music on the computer. She was able to sit down and play the music at the keyboard that we plugged into the computer. And as she started to play, a really wonderful thing happened. She started to sing. And this little girl, I mean, I remember that day. That was my real aha moment when I heard her initiate speech for the first time, because she was able to sing and then she was able to speak. And she ended up being able to mainstream into a regular classroom in second grade. And the last time I saw her, she was actually entering her sophomore year at the University of Texas at Austin, and was doing wonderfully. So it just really was an amazing thing to see this. And I decided at that point, you know, if I'm ever in a position to do anything with this and learn why this is so effective, I want to do that. And so I started a doctorate degree in 2002 at the University of Kansas, and specifically chose Kansas because they're one of the best music therapy groups, schools in the country. And they were able to educate me with a third of my doctoral degree in music therapy, and it was just a wonderful experience. So I learned at that point really why this is so effective, not just that it worked, but why it worked so well. And I founded a nonprofit because I thought, oh, people need to know about this. And unfortunately, not too many people do know about it. It's not really hit the mainstream yet, but it's very, very important work.
Martha, let's take back some of the layers on that and deconstruct it to talk about the physiological or the neuroscience behind it, the connection between the brain and the music. Can you perhaps elaborate on that for us or tell us how music can be a powerful therapeutic tool?
Yeah, it really is an enormously powerful tool. What happens, both hemispheres of the brain are activated by the music. It's not just one specific area. It's all over the brain that's activated by the music. And so basically the brain oscillations start to move in time with music. The heart rate moves with the music. The muscle motor movements go with the music. And everything really starts to hook into the rhythm in the brain. And this can be just a really, really powerful thing when you think about somebody trying to do, let's say, PT when they've had a stroke and they're trying to rehabilitate part of their body and they want to be able to move in rhythm. What happens then is that the movements become a lot more automatic with that. Or if they're having a problem with their speech, they're in, again, stroke rehabilitation, you get all kinds of different problems with. So if they have a problem with speech, the speech centers are in the left part of the front of the brain, and they can be affected by a stroke, but the music reaches all over the brain. And so therefore, speech may not be possible, but singing can be possible. A really effective example of this, if you remember 10 years ago or so, when Congresswoman Gabby Giffords was shot, she could not speak. Her speech centers were pretty much destroyed, but she relearned speech by learning to sing. This was a technique called melodic intonation therapy, or MIT, that is really very powerful for getting speech to flow again when it has not been. Music is also really, really great for cognition. It can help with attention focus. It can help with executive functioning, all kinds of things. And we see actually, one of the interesting things that I found was that when music, when these techniques were first being developed, musicians were a big part of the control groups of the experiments. And they learned that actually musicians' brains are formed a little bit differently because the auditory centers and the motor centers are hardwired together. And what happens when you're using this with therapy with a non-musician is there's this temporary wiring of the motor centers and the auditory centers that helps get things going on this. So it really is a very, very powerful thing.
Okay, Martha, as far as rhythm is concerned, rhythm and enchainment are two topics that you often talk about and was something that you talked about in the neural tango. How does that play into music therapy, rhythm and enchainment?
Rhythm is the basic core function of what the brain is responding to. Yes, it will respond to the harmony and the melody and all the wonderful things we associate with music. But the rhythm is the basic thing that really kicks it all going. And so everybody has also what is called a fundamental tempo that they basically, if you were going down the street and you were tapping your finger on the, you know, on the wheel of your car as you're driving, or you're in your living room and you're just tapping your foot automatically, you'll notice how fast you're tapping that. And that can actually be the tempo that you will respond best to a therapeutic exercise. And for adults, it tends to be anywhere in the range of 72 to 90 beats per minute. For children, it could actually go up to 120, 130 beats per minute, because of course they're wired to go very quickly. And so finding that tempo, very important on that. Typically, it can equate to the heart rate when you're using music for therapy. So you can kind of find that. It can also equate to if you observe how fast somebody is walking and check their beats per minute that they're walking, you can kind of determine it that way too. And the really interesting thing with the therapy is that how this works, we have the basic rhythm, but then if we increase or decrease that basic rhythm by plus or minus 5%, let me give an example of that. So if I'm working with a stroke person, you know, who's walking at only 60 beats per minute, okay, and trying to get them to rehabilitate, I would start them on a walk at 60 beats per minute. But if I increase it by 5%, which is up to 63 beats per minute, they're automatically going to follow without even thinking about it. The brain doesn't realize. And so it just automatically goes into that. So we can actually have therapeutic goals set to either increase or decrease. In the case of a hyperactive child, it might be the exact opposite type thing, where you've got a child running at 130 beats per minute, and you want to get them to slow down. And so you start your metronome at maybe 125 beats per minute, and they're going to follow that. And a few minutes later, you can set it down to 122, and then down and down and down. And the body will naturally follow that without knowing, without being conscious of it. More than that, the research shows that the body is consciously aware and may have a little bit of a kick of, do I want to follow that or not? But up to 5% is just amazing. So with that, when we want to get the entrainment fit into it, the muscles are going to automatically start to move to that beat. The motor functions, the heart rate again, the brain oscillations, everything is going to start to entrain to whatever that beat is that you're working therapeutically with. And things will just start to go much smoother, much faster than if you did not have that beat accompanying it.
So that rhythm and entrainment piece, does that form the foundation of your biomedical music protocols, Martha?
Yes, much of it is. The biomedical music protocols were actually originally, the lab was originally at Colorado State University, and they are now up in Toronto. And it's an incredible place where they are working on new techniques all the time and new research. And rhythm is the main thrust of what they are working with on that. And there are many, many different techniques that are for cognitive, speech, or motor type problems, challenges that people can have that come out of that. Music therapists who specialize in what's called neurologic music therapy, which that's what these biomedical music protocols are, can be referred to as NMTs, neurologic music therapists. And a music therapist who has not had the training is still, of course, a music therapist. They are referred to as MT-BC, which I will also say all music therapists are referred to as that, which is music therapist board certified. So the research continues in Toronto, and of course that's where the lab originated, but there's a lot of other research going on right now with neuroscientists and labs working all over the country trying to work on these techniques.
How can parents listening to this podcast get plugged in to finding out perhaps they may already be able to tell the benefits of music therapy by listening to what we're saying, but how can they get plugged into perhaps a resource, Martha?
Yeah, the American Music Therapy Association is, of course, the organization to go to for this. And you can go to their website, which is musictherapy.org. And they have a place on their website that's called Find a Music Therapist. And you can actually go and list by state or by city in the state, whatever, where you can find a music therapist. So that is for the straight music therapy. You can also, music is beneficial when you use it for music enrichment, for instance, with children with autism. So maybe it might not be working with a music therapist, but with a piano teacher, learning an instrument. There's all kinds of wonderful things wonderful ways that the brain can grow just simply by working with music. As a matter of fact, there's some really interesting studies that were done on musicians that found that if a child starts to learn playing the keyboard before age 7, I believe it is, that their corpus callosum, which is a part of the brain that kind of connects the two pieces of the brain and gets the communication going, their corpus callosum can actually be up to 15% greater than a non-musician because they started working with music at such an early age. And, you know, most kids, of course, you know, they'll get to high school and say, well, I don't have time for this anymore. But that growth in the brain stays. So it's really, you know, the music therapy is wonderful. Music enrichment, just getting involved with music and, you know, getting involved with school bands, school orchestras, you know, music is magic. And it really, you know, however you can work with it is what you need to do.
So the application of music therapy is not necessary for our pediatric patients or children, so to speak. It also has a place to play, for example, with our geriatric patients, those that might have Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. So it does have application throughout the lifespan.
Yes, it absolutely does. And there's fascinating work being done with a lot of people with Parkinson's at this point, too, because they found that in the Parkinson's, the damage in the brain is in an area called the basal ganglia. And unfortunately, we can't really work with neuroplasticity in the basal ganglia. Neuroplasticity is when new network connections are formed in the brain. And music typically creates new, you know, neural networks to be able to work with. That's how you can circumvent the damaged part. But in the case of Parkinson's, it's in an area of the brain that cannot regenerate, but that does not mean that it can't be wonderful, because quality of life can be much better when you just have that beat going. Everybody's carrying around a phone these days, so you could have your favorite music playing. And in the case of Parkinson's, the mechanism of the, shall we say, the stop-go mechanism of the brain is affected when this deterioration of the basal ganglia happens. And so that's why you see a lot of Parkinson's people freezing in gait, just doing total stops. But the music, the rhythm overrides that, and so they just keep going. There's no freeze of gait. I worked my piano master from my days, my ancient days back at my undergraduate, was diagnosed with Parkinson's probably about 15 years or so ago. And when I was up working with him a few years back, he asked me if I could, you know, help him with his gait. And we did this rhythmic walking with him, and he, you know, for a while he was like, okay, what? And then he said, oh, wait, I feel more organized now. And he was still able to concertize at that point. And he said to me the night before a concert, he said, you know what? I'm going to take a metronome backstage with me because I think I can actually walk better on and off stage if I just hear that metronome. And his wife told me later on that that was actually the first time that he had played an encore where he was able to get on and off stage by himself, which was wonderful. Yeah. So it's, you know, a really great thing.
I really want to touch on two things: your work at the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga and your involvement with the music therapy program there, as well as Notes to Block.
Right, right. Yes, and I'm actually not affiliated currently with UTC, but I did help them in getting their music therapy degree program off the ground a few years back, and I am absolutely delighted to report that they just graduated their first class of music therapists, which is fabulous, absolutely fabulous. This was the first state school degree program that Tennessee had in a long, long time, so this was a great thing to have. Now, Notes to Blocks came about from a program I did in 2019 at the Chattanooga Public Library, and I was asked to be able to set up a system where children with autism could sit with their neurotypical peers and learn the same piece of music at the same time. The library had just been gifted some keyboards by UTC, and so they wanted to see innovative ways to use the keyboards. So I came up with this design system of basically just creating a music notation that was colored blocks on grid paper. I had used this kind of thing many years ago when I was working with children with autism. When I was first learning the techniques, they were unable to read music notation. I mean, it was just way too complex, but they could read colors, of course. And so we just did this little color-coded thing with little colored tabs on the keys. And then I drew a little design for them, and it worked great. So we flushed out that design, and it worked wonderfully. The one problem that, you know, it was a very successful program, but the one problem that we had was that I was physically filling in all these little pieces of, you know, graph paper with the notes. And so the kids would have special requests, and I just don't have time to do it. And a friend of mine, who was the former head of the computer science department at UTC, came up and said, "Martha, why don't you automate this?" And I thought, of course, what a great idea. And so we created this system. This friend of mine actually basically did a proof of concept so that we knew that we could read in a music XML file and spit out information. And so then I was able to get a grant from the UN Foundation of Chattanooga and hire a developer to do the work on this. And so what happens is I play into a keyboard that I then, that creates a musical XML file. This is a standard language music file. It's kind of like MIDI is a standard language. XML is a standard language that can be interpreted by computers. And then the XML file is read into a program that spits out these wonderful graphs automatically. This is a system that we have up and running at this point that is now available on the nonprofit website for my nonprofit, and that is mtgic.org. And if you navigate to the projects tab and then navigate down to notes to blocks, everything is there for how to set up your keyboard, the charts, everything. When you go in and you look at the charts themselves, you select, say, you know, I want to learn how to play Happy Birthday with the charts. Happy Birthday will actually, you'll see first, there are actually six charts of Happy Birthday. And the reason for that is some people like to scroll on a device and some people like to print. And so we have three PDF files and three PNG files, one for both hands, one for right hand alone, and one for left hand alone. So you can pick exactly what you want. Yeah. Doing both hands together might be too much for a child with autism or somebody with dementia to start with. And so you might want to start with just the right hand. They could scroll on their device, so you can download a PNG file, or they might want to print, you can download the PDF. So we're trying to be as flexible as we can with all of this. Again, it's totally free of charge to use. All you have to do is go in, select your chart. You can listen to the music. There's a file to listen to each piece also, sample. And then if you like it, you just hit download and it goes to your personal device and you can use it to print out or play from your device.
What a gift, Martha. That is such a legacy. I tell you what, that removes a barrier to learn when you're unable to read the notation that way. So amazing work and kudos to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. It was something that I just, you know, it was like that aha moment when I saw the little girl 30 years ago suddenly start to sing and speak because she could read music. It's music can do all these wonderful things. And people, you know, possibly people even in stroke rehabilitation or people with intellectual or developmental disabilities or seniors, even neurotypical seniors in retirement centers or people who have Alzheimer's, you know, music can be a social thing, or it can be a therapeutic thing, or it can be just a fill your soul type thing. And so we want to have all of these different ways for people who are unable to read music notation, either because they just are unable to physically, or they just think they're too old to, or something like that. You're never too old. That's a hint. You're never too old to learn to play an instrument. Jump in and do it. But you know, we wanted to facilitate all this and be able to get music into the hands of people who really need it.
Martha, thank you so much for taking time on this wintry Wednesday morning to chat with us. And definitely, guys, take a look at Martha's website. That's Music Therapy Gateway in Communication. And that is where the Notes to Block program is housed at. In addition, I will make sure that that reflects in the show notes. Martha, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a delight.
Thank you for listening along on the podcast today. And those websites that Martha made reference to can be found at MarthaSumer.com, and that is spelled MarthaSumma.com. And Notes to Blocks can be located at Music Therapy Gateway in Communications. And this website reference is mtgic.org. As always, thank you for listening along, and we would really appreciate you leaving a rate and review of this podcast episode on your platform. And if you would like to contact us, we can be reached at raisingkillen@gmail.com. Thank you for listening along today and see you all soon. As always, remember, get to the top of your mountain. This is Marsh Naidu signing off.